The Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Anthony Reich, a very, very good morning to you. How are you?
Boker Tov. Yeah, good, thank you. How are you guys doing?
Yeah, very good. Anthony, I don't know that I've got the energy to go through another election.
I did hear the little reference that you made during Ian's discussion about trying to change routines and things like that. Well, if you don't think you've got energy, Howard, imagine how we're feeling right now heading into the summer. And the date that's being discussed for the next round of elections is the 17th of September. I mean, there was a date in August that was mentioned. I think it's August the 27th. But at the moment, the most likely date now seems to be September the 17th. So that'll effectively mean that we will be almost a year without a proper government, without a functioning parliament and without a proper government, which seems just inconceivable.
It's just incredible. It is really quite unbelievable.
The truth of the matter is that, you know, the Prime Minister yesterday addressed the Knesset.
Yeah.
And as one can expect, he loaded a lot of the blame on Avigdor Lieberman, who has refused to compromise on this issue of the Haredi draft bill. But I think that, you know, it's worthwhile just thinking for a moment about this opposition that Lieberman has put in against the Haredi draft bill, because I think that it is not just opposition against the Haredi draft bill. I think this is a very strong message that's being sent to the Prime Minister to say that he should stop capitulating to the demands, continuous, ongoing, very expensive demands of the ultra-Orthodox sector, and that we need to try and put them into the same proportions as all other citizens of Israel. And so while this particular argument is about the draft bill, I think that it represents a much greater discussion that this country is having right now, a real debate that's going on about to what extent, you know, the demands of the ultra-Orthodox community need to be met, particularly when considering the fact that many of them don't work or make a contribution in terms of paying taxes. And many of them, most of them don't serve in the military or don't make any effort to make, you know, to serve in any sort of national service kind of capacity. And so what we want to do is not to break the back of the ultra-Orthodox community in terms of distancing themselves from what they believe in and the way that they like to function. I think that by and large, people want to respect that. But at the same time, we somehow want them to become a little bit more part of Israeli society in the contribution that they make to Israel, not only looking for the handouts, not only looking for the stipends that they're getting from the yeshivot and from the kollel, and, you know, looking for the contributions that the state is making to their education infrastructure. You know, huge amounts of money are being spent on all of these things. And that's fine, and that's okay, and I think that they deserve whatever they deserve in comparison, in proportion to what other average Israelis get. But I think that the main issue is getting them to make a contribution in return to this country. And that's, I think, where the whole thing falls over, because the vast majority of Israelis feel that they have an undue influence over many things that happen in this country while not making a proper contribution and getting good benefits from state handouts. And something needs to be rebalanced here. So I think that this is really what the debate is about, rather than focusing exclusively on the Haredi, the ultra-Orthodox draft bill, which I think just is the kind of the representative element that we're seeing in this debate.
Just to explain it to me, in the past, the Orthodox, or the Haredi parties have been part of the coalition. They basically made up the coalition, which gave them the power or the strength as the kingmaker. Why hasn't that happened under these conditions, in this circumstance?
Well, it would have happened had it not been for Lieberman. Because Prime Minister Netanyahu has effectively agreed with the ultra-Orthodox parties to their demands. And a lot of their demands are not even publicly known. I mean, we don't really even see a lot of their demands in the public sphere in terms of how much money the coalition agreement will agree to contribute towards institutions of learning and educational institutions for the Haredi community. We also don't know, you know, any of the other contributions, financial contributions, which the coalition agreement would have agreed to and which Prime Minister Netanyahu apparently has already agreed to. But I think that this is just a kind of a continuation of what was the case up until now. There was one government when the ultra-Orthodox parties were not for part of the coalition. And we do remember Yair Lapid being very, very determined to cut a lot of the funding off and to make sure that the ultra-Orthodox community gets their fair share, but not more than that. And therefore, a lot of these contributions, the financial support was cut off from the ultra-Orthodox community. And this was, you know, very, very badly received. But since then, they've been back in the coalition, and those changes that were made to their funding have all been reversed now, and they've kind of reverted back to what one would call the kind of business as usual funding, which is that, you know, their institutions are all being funded as required and as demanded, even though many of their institutions don't really even conform to what our Ministry of Education would require in terms of educational basics in their schools and in their yeshivot and things like that. So there is a lot of, you know, there is a lot of consternation about the fact that there is, a certain fear, there's a certain feeling within the Israeli community in general, even amongst some religious people, I'm talking about outside of the ultra-Orthodox community, that ultimately the ultra-Orthodox are getting more than their fair share and making much less of a contribution than other average Israelis.
Really, really fascinating. When will we have complete clarity on this? What's the deadline?
Well, I think that we're going to know more today, because yesterday the first bill, the first reading was passed in the Knesset of the draft bill to dissolve the Knesset. That was passed by a relatively good majority. I understand that today is really the deadline day. I mean, the Prime Minister Netanyahu was last night talking about 48 hours within which an election could be a repeat election could be avoided. I'm not sure yet whether this whole process of trying to dissolve the Knesset is not potentially brinkmanship on the part of the Prime Minister, really just trying to threaten. But Lieberman seems to be very determined in not going to compromise. There was a meeting yesterday held between Lieberman and Netanyahu. It is reported to have lasted 22 minutes exactly, during which time not a great deal really was achieved. And so Lieberman seems to be really holding out on this issue in his anti-ultra-Orthodox point of view. Not anti, but just saying, you know, things need to be balanced out. So I think that later today we will have a clearer picture of exactly what will happen and whether, in fact, there will be another round of elections or not.
And if it does go ahead, if there is the so-called snap election, not that there's ever such a thing as a snap election, does everything start from the beginning? In other words, can it go back now to potentially that Carolyn Glick can form a party and stand for elections? I mean, is it back to square one?
It's pretty much back to square one. I mean, there's a lot of speculation about whether Naftali Bennett and his New Right Party participate again. He's already announced that he has no intention this time of participating in the election at all. We will see. There's talk about Ayelet Shaked joining another party. There's been talk about her joining Likud or joining another party and getting a position on their list. There's been talk about the possibility of Kahol Lavan splitting up into their two component parts, potentially with Lapid going on his own and Gantz going on his own. So there's been, it's effectively back to square one. So there are still many opportunities to do different things and many possibilities indeed of those different things happening.
All right. So just moving on to another subject, which obviously we've been following with some interest. The Israeli Air Force destroyed a Syrian missile launcher yesterday after it fired at an Israeli plane. What do we know about this incident?
So what we are led to believe is that this anti-aircraft missile was fired towards an Israeli fighter jet, which was apparently on a routine mission within Israeli airspace. It wasn't even over the border. It was on the Israeli side of the Golan Heights. And nevertheless, this Syrian missile launch actually launched this anti-aircraft missile towards the Israeli plane. Fortunately, the missile did not hit the plane, and we understand that the missile actually landed within Syrian territory itself, the launcher, the missile, from the anti-aircraft launcher. And what we also understand is that the Israeli Air Force responded immediately, destroying that particular anti-aircraft missile launcher and potentially also killing somebody in the process. We understand from reports that have come from the Syrian side of the border that somebody was actually killed in that retaliation attack that the Israeli Air Force carried out against this Syrian missile launcher. We're told that Syria apparently recently stationed two military brigades in that particular area. And there are some fears on the Israeli side that Hezbollah might well also try to establish a more permanent presence in that area. So obviously Israel is quite sensitive to all of that and is keeping a very, very careful watch on things. But on this particular occasion, the action of firing against this Israeli plane seems to be quite unjustified, given the fact that the plane was really on the Israeli side of the border and within Israeli airspace. So, you know, Israel is showing absolutely no tolerance towards attacks of this sort from the Syrian side of the border.
Is there any understanding why this would have happened? I mean, is this just poor discipline, or is this a strategic attack, do you think? On the side of the Syrians.
It's not exactly clear what led to this attack taking place. We do know that people and equipment and you know, the forces in general are all on tenterhooks in that part of Syria, in the southern part of Syria. We have seen Israel attacking Syrian targets before, you know, particularly targets that are at airports, apparently shipments of goods and shipments of arms and ammunition that have come particularly from Iran. So, of course, Israel has been known to attack on quite a number of occasions. And the moment Israeli aircraft are in the area, there is always a certain fear, there is a certain thought that the Israeli aircraft may well carry out attacks against Syrian targets. And I suppose that being on tenterhooks as things are in that part of the world, there is quite some logic as to why the Syrian missile might have been fired off, even though it was on this particular occasion at least seemingly unjustified. But certainly things are tense around there and things can happen, and it's not quite clear whether this was some sort of a renegade attempt without instruction or whether this was an instruction that was issued from on high. And I'm not sure that we'll really get to know, given that the launcher has been completely destroyed and some of the people in the process. I'm not sure that we're ever going to really find out whether this was something that was orchestrated from senior ranks or this was just some mistake or someone just, you know, doing their own thing on the ground with that missile launcher.
And do we expect any form of follow-up retaliation, or will this just likely disappear?
Well, from the Israeli side, there is no expectation of follow-up.
No, sure.
The reason that I say that is because the residents in that part of Israel, in the Golan Heights in particular, have all been advised that it is business as usual, that schools will be open as usual, and that people do not need to behave in any different way than they would on a normal business day. So if there were concerns about retaliations coming from Syria, then I think that the instructions to the civilians living in that area would be slightly different. But because of the fact that, you know, they've been particularly advised that they need not take any caution and they need not adjust their routines in any way, that is a clear expectation on the side of the Israelis that it is business as usual and that there will unlikely be any response coming from Syria on this issue.
Anthony Reich, it's just gone 8 o'clock. Thank you, as always, for your incredible insights. We'll catch you tomorrow, same time, same place. It is 8 o'clock. Here's your news headlines, followed by the news in detail with